when the Mivart's Hotel opened its doors to the public in Mayfair, London, in 1812. The fanfare did not last long. The hotel's first chef, Jordan Ramsay, was proving unpopular with patrons. The source of their displeasure were the bizarre creations on Ramsay's menu, which included, among others, throat pie, tureen of a weasel cock, ant, and peppered dog's teeth. The proprietors of Mivart's Hotel acted swiftly. Ramsay and his entourage of Ugandan fish slappers were dismissed in such a manner that would contravene today's European employment laws. However, the damage to the Mivart brand was irrevocable. Fortunately, this was a time of great social reform and positive change, so the owners dispensed with the hotel's original title and moved forward with a name now synonymous with fine dining and decadent posturing, Claridge's. Social reform was rife. It was the trend, the buzzword, the "oh, look at me, why don't ya?" If you weren't socially reforming, then you were probably off fishing somewhere. The speed of change was breathtaking. One day, incarcerated prisoners would be wretched, malnourished souls in rags. The next, they'd be sporting the finest Louis Vuitton shirts and hot pants, and snarfing down venison tart and yards of Hofmeister. Of course, the reforms weren't all of equal value. While the arrest, trial and punishment of the Tall Puddle Martyrs led to the foundation of modern-day trade unionism, the arrest, trial and punishment of piss bottle Farquhars merely led to the resumption of hostilities between Istanbul and Constantinople. I'm Sir General Roland Frampton, and I'll be recognising the sweat, blood and tears of those who didn't quite make the grade. So the next time you find yourself describing the humility of Edwin Chadwick's Poor Law Amendments of 1834 to a self-absorbed politician or dino rod employee, kindly remember, schoolboy Charlie Smithers was proposing exactly the same changes to legislation, but was unable to break out from the workhouse he was incarcerated within. We live in a world of fine margins.
A Brief History of Failure, presented by Sir General Roland Frampton. Episode 5, The Age of Reform.
So, let us away to the period between 1830 and 1850, the Age of Reform, and prepare to broaden acceptance and heighten opportunity. A great awakening which, if it wasn't for the shit-tossing Luddites, forever waiting in the shadows, might have finally rid us of the inevitable spanner in the works. The Great Reform Act of 1832 radically changed the electoral system in the United Kingdom. It created new constituencies in places such as Birmingham, London and Newport Pagnell, while removing the corruption of the rotten boroughs. The Act was only passed after a third bill had been presented to Parliament, the previous two having failed to meet the expectations of infantile ministers. The first bill had asked for middle-class men to have the vote and for goats to be recognised as masons. The builders and not the filthy bunch of freeloaders who spend society meetings practising secret ball shakes. The second bill asked for votes, an expanded electorate and the right to take your wife shopping on a Wednesday afternoon, providing there was sufficient cloud cover. Both bills were petitioned by the fourth Duke of Ormskirk, Carol Beveridge's. They were swiftly revoked by the Speaker of the House on the grounds that A, goats can't keep a secret, and B, Wednesday is half-day closing. I'm here outside New Scotland Yard, home to the latest state-of-the-art detectivization, and, of course, the filth. I'm going inside momentarily to meet with police archivist Dominic Gotcha. However, I'm currently handcuffed to a lamppost as a result of a misunderstanding between myself, a lady police officer, and a bag of sprouts.
Sir Robert Peel founded the new Metropolitan Police Service in 1929. Teams of Peelers, as they were known, were soon patrolling the capital streets.
I understand, Mr. Gotcha, other regional forces had previously tried unsuccessfully to get squads of licensed thugs to roam their towns unchecked.
They did, Sir Roland. The Walsall Ancillary Cop Squad, or WANCS as it was known, was shut down after only 6 weeks of operation as a result of an outbreak of reticence. Bradford's Unified Garrison, or BUGS as it was known, fell apart at the recruitment stage when their chief inspector, Arthur Firmhands, stipulated anyone applying had to be a minimum of 11 feet tall. One final example I've stumbled across was the Tamworth Ordnance of Secret Squirrels, or TOSS as it was known. This law-enforcing outfit was never taken seriously, given the officers' costumes.
Fascinating, Mr. Gotcha. So, unlike the Peelers, the Wankers, Buggers and Tossers just couldn't get their shit together?
No.
In 1833, the first British Factory Act was passed and adopted by the government of the day. The Act's aims addressed concerns about the safety, education and exhaustion of child labourers. A similar bill was passed by the Icelandic government around the same time, and I have a copy on my desk in front of me here. This bill, proposed by far-right Reykjavik MP Egbert No Toast, did see the light of day, but it was swiftly replaced after a PTA meeting and a parental outcry over Rule Number 5. As my Icelandic is a little rusty, I've invited schoolgirl Björk Björksson to translate and read the bill for us. Hello, Björk, and thanks for doing this.
Totally cool, Sir Frampton. Rule 1. No child workers under the age of 9 months. Rule 2. Children working at night must employ sign language to communicate so as not to wake the neighbours. Rule 3. No books, guitars or petting. Rule 4. Children are permitted 3 breaks, breakfast, lunch and forearm. Rule 5. Child workers must spend all their earnings at the factory's on-site tuck shop.
Rule 5 went against the country's strict laws on monopolies and overconsumption of wagon wheels.
Can I have my money now?
Yes, but only if you spend it at the tuck shop.
Fuck off.
The abolitionist movement was as popular as a pig in a girdle in the 1800s.
Scotty Dangrader is a Marxist librarian at the School of Enlightenment in Union, New Jersey.
The movement gained momentum in New York in the early 19th century and quickly spread through the northern states. Abolitionists believed slavery to be morally wrong and that it violated the U.S. principles of equality and freedom.
Scotty were all abolitionists, fully understanding of the goals of the movement.
Not exactly, Sir Roland. There were several factions who had alternative agendas and set about freeing things that, well, to be frank, didn't really require freeing.
Such as?
Cartographers.
Cartographers?
There was an astonishing number of raids on the houses of men and women who drew maps. They would be taken kicking and screaming from their homes, placed in a wagon, driven to a remote scrubland, and released into the wild.
Good Lord. What ultimately happened to these land tracers?
The great emancipators who freed them would celebrate wildly into the night, safe in the knowledge their deeds were worthy. While they indulged in a night of revelry, the cartographers simply walked back home. The scrubland was never more than 100 yards out of town.
Astonishing. What other splinter groups were active at this time? Who else was being freed unnecessarily?
Pigeon ticklers?
Social change was coming for everyone. Middle-class men, poor men, men with cataracts, men with spines like melons. Crime men and men of crime. The only men being left behind were women. This, however, was about to change as the women's suffrage movement on both sides of the Atlantic Sea put the rights of the more caramelicious sex front and centre.
You had the likes of Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Susan B. Anthony advocating for women's suffrage, property rights and access to education and employment.
Audrey Trough is an activist who campaigns for everything from women's rights and equal pay to releasing the Edgeworth Colliery Brass Band 6.
A lot of the work of these brave women was, however, undermined by a few feminists who tried spectacular stunts to grab the headlines, but only ended up setting the movement back years.
Ms. Trough, I understand an appeal for the Edgeworth Colliery Brass Band 6 is going to be heard in the Old Bailey next month.
And that's great news, Sir Roland, but I'd rather focus on the failings around the suffrage movement, if you don't mind.
Oh, yes, of course.
Gabby Vasnek, a housewife from Connecticut, strapped herself to a marmoset, rushed into the New York Public Library and took out a copy of Sense and Sensibility without using standard lending procedures. The press had a field day with her, calling her actions crass and unbecoming of a professional fire eater. The suffrage leadership was mortified.
And I believe they're being permitted to take their instruments into court.
Yes. Anyway, that was nothing compared to Florence Mopp's outrageous attempt to steal the flag of ambivalence from the old courthouse in Springfield, Ohio, a symbol of the US's lack of ambition for centuries and sacred to millions. On Thanksgiving Day, 1845, Mopp charged the courthouse dressed as a turkey. She barely reached the courthouse steps before she was apprehended, butterballed and fed to the Rochester family. Even the president was heard to say, "If women want progress, turkey deviation is not the way. It's simply unacceptable. I find it remarkable we ever got the vote after that."
And that some of the other band members are joining them for, you know, old time's sake. By the middle of the 19th century, reform legislation on safety in mines and factories, public health and prison conditions had also been adopted by the government. Less successful reform legislation that wasted valuable time in the House and reduced the opportunity for a proper knees-up in the Stranger's Bar in the Palace of Westminster, centred around land rights for necromancers, public wailing and free access to fluoride toothpaste. But as the snowflakes of the day concerned themselves with how bad this was and how shit that was, and shouldn't so-and-so really stop being an utter bastard, revolution was back on the agenda. But this time, it was industrial. Next time on A Brief History of Failure, as Henry Bessemer advances the technology in steel production from molten pig iron, I'll be examining how baking failed to add any improvement to the process.
Shop owner Fanny Haddock insisted that the ganache she used on her cream puffs was the perfect consistency for the smelting process. She was deluded, of course, and sectioned.
And as Samuel Crompton's spinning mule begins the production of the finest yarns, I'll be asking why Boris Pendragon's spinning donkey was ever entertained as a serious contraption.
Pendragon demonstrated his spinning donkey 3 times. First, at the Accrington Society for Brilliant Textiles. Second, for the newly established Board of Trade and Industry. And a third and final time at Clitheroe's Institute for the Clinically Insane.
And as the Chance brothers produce the first sheet of glass in their West Midlands factory, I'll be investigating how that groundbreaking development proved more practical for letting in light than the plates of iron proposed by the Magdalen sisters or the coatings of horseshit suggested by the Guff-Winkle twins. All this and more next time on A Brief History of Failure.
A Brief History of Failure was written performed and produced by me, Aid Corey. A book of this podcast is available from Amazon. And on Instagram, you can get additional content at A Brief History of Failure.